Hello, welcome to Bees with Ben podcast. Thank you for joining us today and we're really glad to have you here. This podcast is designed for you, a community of enthusiastic, like-minded people who want to hear the journeys of others, learn more about these crucial, fascinating insects and how to become better beekeepers. Here's your host, Ben Moore.
Hey everybody, Bees with Ben. Boy, have I got an episode today. I have an absolute amazing beekeeper. You know what? Actually, I'm going to say guru because she sent me her CV in and I was reading it and I am gobsmacked. Absolutely blown away. What an amazing, amazing person. And I'm so looking forward to having Elizabeth Frost. Thank you so much for your time, Liz.
Thanks so much, Ben. Really pleased to be here.
Oh, this is awesome. Now, as I said, your CV is like, you are the guru because, you know, we'll go back over 10 years ago. So you're from California?
Yeah, from California originally.
Awesome. Right. And you were working with bees over in the States. So tell us how it all started. How are you getting into bees?
Yeah, well, I guess it all started as a child viewing an observation hive every summer on the way to the family's ghetto cabin in Lake County and stopping off at a candle shop. So you get hooked early and then you kind of, for me, I came back to it, studying at University of California and realizing entomology, study of insects was something you could, you know, that study and lead into a career with. And I just had to find my target organism. So I was distracted by forensic entomology for a while, but I'm glad I found bees because it smells much better.
Forensic, so wow, I know exactly what that's about. So that would be kind of full on, you know, forensic entomology.
Yeah, a bit full on. It's all about, the corpse habitat and yes, what species are there or not there, and fascinating stuff. It's the same thing with beekeeping. It's a puzzle. So it's the attraction of beekeeping as well as in Australia in particular, that all of our floral resources, well, the most productive ones are these species that are not annual flowers or eucalypts and their relatives. So there's a lot of intrigue about beekeeping that was just the right fit.
Yeah, awesome. And so what were you doing in California? So started with obviously keeping bees and
I grew up there and went to uni and worked at any insect lab that had a job and would hire me basically. So worked in labs with rice pests and cotton pests and bean pests. Most of the studies in California at that time were about pest insects and how to kill them quicker and cheaper. Okay. And eventually they had some new hires at the bee lab there. And so I rode my bike and Susan Kobe, who's a, an international bee breeder guru in artificial insemination of queen bees, she got hired. And so I started volunteering, just, you know, your classic way to start beekeeping, find a good mentor and, you know, learn as much as you can, ask as many good questions and just be open and prepared to learn and work hard. So that's how it kind of started.
Okay, cool. And moving forward a little bit, so you've decided to come to Australia. So how did that all sort of transpire, Liz?
Yeah, well, I was working for the Bee Informed Partnership, which is a USDA grant funded non-for-profit initiative where these technician teams would work with commercial beekeepers in different beekeeping hotspots in the States. And so I worked on this team for two seasons and I moved every 3 months for those 2 years working in between California queen breeders and Midwestern honey producers. Okay. And so I just got a little bit burnt out at the end, moving every 3 months. And I had quit the job in winter. And so no beekeeper was going to hire you in, you know, North America in winter. And so I thought, oh, maybe I'll contact some contacts of Sue Covey out in Australia, because she came out here for the second Bee Congress in 1988. And she'd come out here since in 2009 to run an AI, Queen Bee AI course at Gretchen Wien's in Richmond at her farm. And so she set me up with some contacts. So I came out here and worked bee season in 2013-14 season. Yeah. So worked for queen breeder in Southeast Queensland, NT Bees, and extracted honey with the Horners in Ralston, and then went over to WA and worked with Ron Clark and somebody in Queens over there. So that was the taste, the first taste.
Wow. Okay. So then you've gone back home and you thought, you know what, we like the Aussies, and sort of, did you come back?
Yeah, I did come back. Yes. So Ron Clark of Rolling Stone WA told me about a temporary job with the Department of Primary Industry. So I worked there for 10 months, short-term job. I applied for it while I was overseas, did the interview overseas, and after the interview, I was working for Queen Brewer at the time, and I walked outside, and my friend's reading a book, and I look out in the yard, and I said, "That's a rattlesnake." Literally a rattlesnake right there. And anyway, so the snake connection is strong between California and Australia. We've got the snakes sorted as well.
That's funny. And so in regards to keeping bees, and now we'll take varroa mite out of the equation to make it sort of easy, but what sort of differences other than the varroa keeping bees in Australia to back home?
Yeah, big differences. Obviously, it's the same species. It's got genetic similarities. You know, bees aren't native to Australia or the U.S., but they're managed in, you know, commercial scales. U.S., I'd say the scale is, commercial scale is typically larger because they're more, I guess, oriented around pollination these days. So it's the typical, I suppose, growing a business in numbers as you see, I don't know, livestock numbers getting larger and business income coming from different streams. So it's really not kind of a landscape for large honey crops anymore. There's been a great change in land usage. So it used to be, you know, smaller farms and more crop rotation and a diverse landscape of flora, as well as, I guess, less urbanization. So now it's a pretty intensified landscape out there. And pollination pays more than honey. The honey price is really terrible in the U.S. So it's hard to be a honey producer alone. So almond pollination, everybody revolves around in the States. And comparatively, I suppose, the States rely on annual flowering plants for honey production by and large, whereas here we've got the eucalypts produce like 70% or more of our honey in the nation, and depending on soil moisture and rainfall and, you know, year on year droughts and whatnot, they could flower every 2 years, every 3 years, or just take a big old break and flower maybe in 10 years when the soil moisture is right.
Okay.
So it's harder in Australia from that perspective. Obviously, varroa makes it really hard in the States, but the eucalypts and, you know, we're the most arid populated country in the world here in Australia. So that makes it challenging for beekeeping at any scale at times, but certainly at a large scale. It's challenging because you need that botanical know-how.
Yes, of course. Exactly. And so speaking of sort of the flora, what are the main nectar flows coming through when you're working with bees in the States?
So when I was at UC Davis, I worked at the lab there for 4 years and managing 180 colonies. And there we really only had one nectar flow, one honey production event. And then the rest, obviously, they're research hives, so we weren't taking them to pollination. They were used for queen breeding purposes, counting mites and doing hygienic behavior testing and breeding queens and delivering courses in queen breeding and artificial insemination. But there we would get a bit of ground flora, ground flora, a.k.a. in California, weeds, weed species, so blackberry, star thistle, which here I think it's similar to St. Barnaby's thistle. I'm not sure if you have that down in Vic. Probably in some areas you would. And beekeepers say when it's really pure, it's like it's got a greenish tinge. It's like a bright yellow with a greenish tinge. And that's like, mwah, so delicious. Okay. Love that one. But there's different native plants in California that you can get a good crop off if you, you have the apiary sites like manzanita in early spring is a beautiful light honey, or rabbit brush, which also is a good propolis producer. Some research has been done on that.
Okay.
And so there's some good native honeys. Southern California used to be a huge honey production zone with all the different native sages, white sage and button sage, different bits and pieces.
Yeah, wow. Well, and then you mentioned obviously, you know, sort of royal might, sort of dealing with them and the queens and the hygienic behaviour. So for the listeners, which is, you know, predominantly Australian, I think over 80%, you know, how bad are they, you know, on a commercial scale?
How
do you treat for them and how bad were they?
Yeah, really. So they're really bad. That they underpin, you know, the successful honey crop or the completely dead hive. So when I first started beekeeping, I thought to myself, I just didn't quite believe it when I first started. And I didn't treat two hives that I started with in my backyard, and they both died because of extremely high varroa mite levels. Okay. To the point where there was lots of deformed wing virus exhibited, parasitic mite syndrome, which is when you've got really peppered brood. It's not because of a foul brood reason. It's because there are multiple female mites going into open cells with larvae, and the cell gets capped, and then more than one mite reproduces in there and produces just a, you know, a large population of progeny, to the point where the bees sense that there's a lot more going on in the cell than there needs to be, and the bees start to uncap it. And so you get this really spotty brood pattern because the brood is, you know, really being affected by this mite feeding, which happens during the bee's development under the capped, capped cell. So I didn't quite appreciate the severity of it when I first got into beekeeping. I was reading, you know, ABC and XYZ beekeeping cover to cover, and just learning heaps as I went along. But I thought, as a scientist and an insect student, I thought I have to see it from my own eyes. And it was really a really hard lesson because those two hives died. I didn't treat them. I should have. And from there, I learned, you know, it's integrated pest management is what you have to get into. Yes. So it's like, you know, you treat your dog or your cat at a certain point. Either you give them regular treatments for fleas and ticks, or you have a point where you do. And you need to know that point for your bees, too, over there. So you need to know how to do a sugar shake, for example, or an alcohol wash, and at what level. You know, is it 3 mites per 100 bees? Is that when you treat, or is it 1 mite per 100 bees for commercial operator? It might be as low as 1 mite per 100 bees in a sugar shake or alcohol wash, which is your decision to treat. And there's a range of treatment methods. So there's organic acids, there's inorganic, treatments, so chemical treatments. There are physical treatments. Like, for example, this is one you really have to get on top of, though. You can put in a frame of drone comb because developing drone larvae are much more attractive to varroa mites to develop and reproduce in and feed off of than workers because they have a longer life or longer development period.
Okay.
So the varroa mite kind of gets baited with this drone brood, but you really have to be on top of it and track that brood to make sure once it's capped, you pull it out and you chuck it in the freezer. So in that way, you've created a bit of a mite sink. They're attracted to that drone brood, and they're populating that capped. They're trapped in the capped brood until it hatches, until the adult drone hatches, and then they go find other larval open cells to inhabit, reproduce. And so if you do that, that's one, you know, physical means of trapping varroa mite and taking a percentage of the mites out of the colony, but this leads into future protein then as well, because if you have that drone pupae source, you can freeze it and then you can eat it as a source of human protein.
Okay.
If you're really gung-ho about not wasting anything.
let's just hope in Australia we don't get them, because it's some fantastic programs and preventions and sentinel hives across ports.
Absolutely.
Yeah, hopefully we don't get those. And now I find this absolutely fascinating. You've done a lot of work with artificial insemination. So talk us through that, Liz, like maybe the positives and the negatives in that.
Yeah, sure. AI. Absolutely. So I suppose artificial insemination in any livestock species, that's a means to control mating and to enable the farmer or the scientist to select for certain things about that animal and to either maintain that trait or decrease a trait, like if it's temperament, if it's an aggressive cow or a really angry bee, you can decrease that aggression, or you can increase certain production traits. So with the honeybee, I guess artificial insemination has only been really perfected quite recently.
Okay.
It was in the 50s and 60s that agricultural scientists in the States really nutted it out in terms of bee anatomy. And it's used in bee breeding, particularly because the queen, to be well mated, she needs to mate with at least an average of 12 drones.
Okay.
So 12 different fathers that she mates with, and she stores that sperm for life. And the workers in her colony, they sense that if she's well mated or poorly mated with too few drones. So that that mating flight that she goes out on and meets with drone congregations who may be coming for, you know, kilometers and kilometers and kilometers away, 8 kilometers or more, they might fly to that drone congregation area to find their virgin queen. So you don't, I suppose, have control in that situation of what that stock is like. It could be a really swarmy strain of bees
that's
coming to that congregation area. It could be, you know, it could be the best bee out there. It could be a bee that's really suited to that environment. So it just depends. Like you don't need AI in all situations. I'll put that out there. But I guess why we're using it in the Honeybee Genetic Improvement Program, we're testing both AI and naturally mated queens, but we're using it because we want to make some increases in production traits like honey production, brood viability, resistance to chalk brood, temperament in particular. And also because this queen breeding program is one of several, in the history of bee research, but this one, we have a lot of stakeholders in the horticulture industry.
Okay.
So the almond industry and the blueberry and avocado industries, they've put funds into this program because they can see that, you know, Australia is in a great situation because we don't have varroa, but we're also in a bit of a tenuous situation because if we get varroa, you know,
yes,
are we ready for it?
That's right.
Are we at that point where our hives are as healthy as they could be, that if we get this, you know, the top challenge for any beekeeping industry, I mean, tropolelaps might probably would be a greater challenge, but I hope we get, before we get tropolelaps. Anyways, with our great border control programs and the National Bee Pest Surveillance Program, hopefully it will never get here. But with artificial insemination, that's a control method where we can take those records that we collect through the season in terms of a colony's production capacity. So you can decide on whatever traits are important to your recreation or your sideline business or your commercial business. Say it's honey production and brood viability and less chalk brood.
Okay.
And so you're collecting this information through the year and you've got, you know, you've got a scoring for each one, which one's the most valuable to you. So it could be honey production, and if it has a little bit of chalk brood, it still produces heaps of honey, then you'll, you know, give that one a tick above the one that has no chalk brood but a little bit less honey production. For whatever reason, it's exhibiting those things. So artificial insemination is just a tool where you can make quicker increases in the traits that you're selecting for.
Okay.
As long as you have enough information on those traits, and I suppose the downside could be that you could potentially increase the speed of inbreeding in any species where artificial insemination is used. So that would be, I would say, the biggest downside. So you really have to know what is the origin of these bees that you're selecting. How closely related are they? But I will say that the honeybee has a really high rate of recombination in genes. So not only does she mate, you know, in a drone congregation area with 12 drones or more, one Sydney Uni study, I think, said there was a case where a queen had mated with upwards of 30 drones.
Okay.
So not only is she mating with a diversity of drones, because that practice has evolved because it results in a more fitter colony, more productive and able to cope with stressors, colony like that. Oh my gosh, have I lost the train?
Well, this is fascinating, absolutely fascinating. This is amazing. And so, what about talk us through? Obviously, it's probably one of those visual things, but just give us a sort of quick overview. How the artificially inseminated queen bee?
Yes. So don't have too many cups of coffee first. And okay. It takes a, yeah. So you need a microscope. So it's called a dissecting microscope. So if you were looking at, you know, any small thing you wanted more detail, you wanted to see more detail through, you'd use one of these types of microscopes. There is no dissection required, but that's what the microscope is called. And you need a specific instrument that's machined for artificially inseminating queen bees.
Okay.
Many people call it an instrumental insemination because it's much, much different from other livestock artificial insemination in that way. So the queen is anesthetized. You know, you collect the drone, seen her prior to, and she requires, yeah, two doses of carbon dioxide for the anesthesia during the dosage of that sperm. And she, let's see here. She might start laying as early as 4 days after insemination, but okay. That's like the soonest that she would start laying after insemination.
Okay. And what's the average after AI?
You'd want her to be laying eggs. If she wasn't laying eggs within 7 to 8 days, I would probably give her another dose of carbon dioxide, which stimulates egg laying. So researchers found that this carbon dioxide anesthesia mimics something physiologically that happens when she goes on that mating flight. So with AI, she doesn't go on the mating flight. So there's some something that happens when she does go on those mating flights, this buildup of CO2 from flight muscles and from the exertion of going to the drone, the congregation area, and coming back. That at this stage, they're thinking CO2 simulates that, but there's a lot we don't know. I mean, we only just learned from Dr. Samuel Ramsey a couple of years ago that varroa is not sucking on blood, it's sucking on the bee's fat body. There's heaps we have yet to learn.
Wow, that's fascinating, Liz. That's absolutely incredible. So, and now speaking about queens, obviously, you know, you're heavily involved with the Plan B. Now Plan B, tell the listeners all about this.
Yeah, so Plan B, that's our shorthand for the Australian National Honeybee Genetic Improvement Program. And that program came about because we're at a bit of a tough point with the queen breeding sector. We're really reliant on, you know, one queen breeder who's collecting copious records and making strategic and targeted decisions on crossing different lines. So the Horners collect detailed records on chalk brood levels, honey production levels, a trait called work, which is the organization of wax within the hive. So they select against burcomb and bracecomb.
Wow. That's
and incredible. They select for bee color, they select for bee size, and they select for overwintering and orientation of honey and pollen in the brood nest as well.
That's incredible.
Because they want, for their conditions, they want to be able to, if the countryside isn't telling those bees we're in a, you know, nectar flow mode, they want their bees to shut down. And they do. They've selected them over time. And they control mating as well, but not through artificial insemination. This, if you haven't heard this story yet, it'll blow your mind. So they used to travel hours and hours and hours from the Central West out to the desolate hay plains, only desolate from the perspective of a bee, like great for a plains wanderer or an emu, but not for a bee because they need trees to eat stuff. So they used to truck all their queen mating nukes out there for geographic isolation of mating. And then, you know, one year they're driving back really late and Joe Horner's wife, Sonia, was like totally over it. And she said, well, why don't we just build some, you know, little railroad tracks and we can railway, you know, truck the nukes out of this shed and they'll mate at a certain time when we want them to. And we'll control it that way. And so they built the bloody thing.
Okay.
They built this refrigerated shed and these tiny little train tracks for three-way, oh no, they're three-way, they're four-way. I think they're four-way nucleus colonies because there's an entrance on each side of the box.
Yes.
It's a two-frame nuc, and they remain in this refrigerated shed throughout the day. And then at dusk, they've got a free-flying spotter hive with drones. And when they see those free-flying drones coming back to the hive, they know any feral colonies, their drones will also be returning. So at that point, they go up to this, they call it the controlled flight time mating shed.
Yes.
And they fire up the generator, they open the doors, and they take the nukes out on these little train tracks on either side and release the drones. And the queens, at this stage, they've been doing it for so long, the queens are mating at an average of 9 minutes.
Oh, yeah, wow.
So they're still flying out to a drone congregation area in that instance, but it's controlled through through timing. So, and Sydney Uni did a study on the percentage of mates that the queen had to the Horner's selected drones, and it was 85% or greater matings to their selected drones with that timing control free flight mating. So it's a bit of a it's a world leading invention, that one. So they're really
it's cool. Yeah. That's a cool invention. And what about now? We've got coming up, and this I'll get this podcast out way before then, but which is shortly is on the 2nd of July.
Yes.
You're doing
so 2nd of July.
Yeah, what's happening there?
So Dr. Nadine Chapman from Sydney Uni and I have been working away with industry stakeholders and input on our standardized trait selection manual. So it it's a bit of a mouthful, but what we hope it will do is allow beekeepers to think about their breeding objectives. So what's the point of your queen breeding? Is it simply to replace queens, or do you want to, say, decrease aggression or swarming tendency, or increase honey production, or propolis production, or decrease chalk brew? What would you like to increase or decrease in your beehives? And once you know that, how will you select for it? So in this manual, it's pretty much a go-to for all the various traits that Australian beekeepers have told us they would like to have the ability to select for or purchase a queen for, the definitions for those traits, and a standard way of recording those traits.
Okay.
So it's a how-to, I suppose, for anyone interested in queen breeding or looking to take the next step but not quite sure how to go about it. So it tells you different ways for tracking honey production. It gives you spreadsheets or data sheets as an example for how you might record these things over time. And then importantly, with the queen breeding program, we're managing our own stock, but we're also working with external queen breeders that collect their own data. They're managing and selecting within their own stock, but they want to take it to the next level. And to do that, we've got University of New England has an animal genetics and breeding unit, and they've created a database so that not only can Department of Primary Industries put all, our data in on the stock that we've sourced from around the country, but queen breeders from, any state and territory can input their data. And if there's enough data and background information on queen origin, pedigree information, then UNE can generate an analysis, so an estimated breeding value for that that particular queen or population of queens. So it's a bit of a different one in terms of we've got the centralized, the classic kind of state government-based breeding program, but also we are opening it up to queen breeders so that if they're not interested in the stock we're breeding because they're doing their own thing and they're already on the track of breeding a bee for their particular conditions and purposes, then that's great. And we want to help them get even better.
That's awesome. And now you mentioned the manual. Is the manual available now, Liz? Or how do we...
It's not available now because we're just... it's in a draft form. So at that meeting, we'll talk about estimated breeding values and the concept of a breeding objective. We'll talk about the trait definition section, and we will give out to folks who flag they want to go to that meeting. It'll be on Zoom.
Yes,
and exactly. if everyone attending agrees, I should say, we'll record it and make it available. Otherwise, we'll have other training recordings available. So the manual we will have available this winter, because our goal is that we'll recruit some beekeepers to start collecting data with our assistance or on their own if they're comfortable enough and ready to go next spring, and we can start to input data into this database at University of New England. So we will make it available for folks, but for the 2nd of July Friday meeting, we'll be focusing on the trait definitions and a few data sheets.
Cool.
So just a taste to start with. But it's in the process with our SoCal College textbook writer. She's looking through it all. We write the Ag Guide series that some beekeepers might be familiar with here at SoCal College and through DPI. So we're trying to get it kind of as an appendix to the Ag Guide for Queen Bee Breeding.
Okay. And are you working on the Plan B full-time, Liz?
No, not full-time. So in addition to Plan B, I'm working on a part-time master's by research. And with my role as technical specialist, there is a requirement for when there's emergencies, whether it's a climate emergency or a pandemic emergency, to work at making sure these different things affect the industry as little as possible. So, for example, with increasing COVID cases now, we're meeting with interstate government and beekeeping industry bodies to make sure that we've got border control as seamless as possible for our beekeepers going to pollination, and in the bushfires, working on justifying assistance for beekeepers affected by these either drought or bushfires. So there's a few things boiling in the background, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But Plan B is most of my time.
Cool. Okay. Oh, because what I'll do is I'll put the Plan B with the workshop in the show notes and on socials, just so people are aware of that. Because that sounds absolutely
great.
Oh, amazing. You're such a wealth of knowledge and all these things you're writing and doing. And there's one good one as well, which once again I'll put this in the show notes. You published a really cool article on poem in 2 Million Blossoms, which I had Kirsten Traynor.
I did my background check on you, Ben, who's he? And I was like, you talked to Kristen already. So that was cool.
Yes,
I didn't get a chance to listen to heaps of them, but I cherry-picked.
Thank you.
Dory was so good. That was really cool.
Awesome. Thank you. Yeah, I was sort of getting better at doing the podcast, because back then I didn't know how to edit it. So podcast, I was kind of like plug and play, but now I'm getting better and learning about it.
Exactly. And the most recent one, Jack Schick, isn't he a legend?
Oh, awesome. In Lord Howe Island, obviously this bloody bug that's, COVID's a bit annoying, but...
better get over there.
Oh, I know. It looks absolutely amazing. So, last question, because you're giving me so much awesome, valuable time, Liz. Where would you like to go? What would you like to see and what would you like to do?
Oh, just in general, not necessarily beekeeping related.
Either.
That's okay. I'm a mad bird birder. So I would love to see a plains wander. So my goal, it's an endangered Australian bird, but it's a evolutionarily extremely unique bird, and it's got a few patchy fragmented habitat zones kind of in the riverina and I need to get my Victorian regions down. I'm only a new Australian, you see, so I can't quite remember them all. Wimmera and Goulburn Valley down in there, and Bendigo area, and that's kind of its stronghold at this stage. So I'll be trucking research hives with Slavi Nenov, our bee manager, to almond pollination this year in Darlington Point. So I might go on a little nighttime wander looking for plains wanderers.
That's awesome. Are they the plains wanderer? Are they migratory? Do they?
No, they're a ground dwelling bird. So they're in the kind of open grasslands. Thus, the habitat's quite fragmented from grazing and different farming competition and urbanization.
That is cool. Well, now, if you come to Melbourne and you've got some free time, I'll take you to a spot, and it's actually my parents' place, and they get the helmeted honeyeater and yelling bow. And that's
My goodness.
Yes.
And the orange-bellied parrot, that's another migration. I need to head near the salt marshes near airports and sewage treatment plants. They're hot spots. So I'm always up for a sewage treatment plant jaunt.
That's awesome. It's actually interesting too. It's, you know, so many beekeepers are actually into sort of bird watching and sort of aviculture, which is awesome.
That's yeah, really cool. it's a recreation and vocation that suits the nature lover to a T.
Exactly. Now, Liz, I am so grateful for your time. You're absolutely, truly amazing. Keep up your amazing work. You're an absolute guru. And
pleasure to speak with you.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing. You take care. All the best, Liz.
Thank you so much for your time.
Take care. Bye.
Catch you. Bye.
Wow. How amazing is Liz? I'm just absolutely blown away. She's absolutely, truly a gem and such a wealth of knowledge. And she's so busy and working. And she's just in the evening took out a valuable time to record with me in the podcast. So Liz, absolutely amazing. And keep up your amazing work. So, and once again, everyone, thank you for the listeners who listen to the podcast. And don't forget, you know, I mean, if you want to hear someone, you know, I'm getting all these, you know, Liz was actually, I think I had half a dozen people. Actually, no, it was more. You know, people send me a message and go, got to get Liz Frost on. She is absolutely the guru of all gurus. So it was really, really cool. So if you want to hear someone, send me a text or an email. A text is good, 0437077792. If you want to hear something or, you know, you got a point, you know what I mean? Is you want to tell me something, how I can make it better, because this is about you, the listener. So absolutely awesome. Now, speaking of which, I had a message today from a beekeeper called Josh, and he asked me the question why I don't use queen excluders. Now queen excluders for me, this is what best thing about bees, because there is so much to learn. There is just so much. So for a commercial point of view, having your brood box, queen excluder, honey super is ideal. So because you can obviously, honey super's full, obviously you pull it off and you know you're not going to get the queen or any brood, anything like that. So that's why it works well. But for me, my way is I like to keep the bees sort of as natural as possible, and the best I can. I'm not a perfect beekeeper by any means, but I'm always learning, and that's part of the reason I love doing this podcast is, you know, learning every individual person. You hear what they do and what they little tricks of the trade and so forth. But for me, so I try and keep them as natural as possible. But also too, they seem to do better because when they're not on a flow, they cannot want to push past that because, you know, that queen excluder between the gaps is about 4.1 mil. And if you do use a queen excluder, my opinion is use a steel one because the bars are rounded. The bees can squeeze through easier than the plastic ones because the plastic ones have a square edge and sometimes the bees can be reluctant to use them. So, and they'll use them when there's a heavy nectar flow. They'll push past them. But if there's not much going on, it can actually create a little bit of a barrier. So if it's in between seasons or, you know, if you're in the certain suburbs of, you know, and there's not a heap going on, they can actually sort of stay put. Now, once again, there's always variables to this. The other reason for me why I don't use a queen excluder is when I do more about, as I said, honey, which I'll talk about in a sec, and I don't do so much honey, more about creating splits and sort of and colonies. So the issue is with that, it allows them to grow up normal, right? But the issue is with the honey, I take less. But what happens is, actually, this is what I recommend if you're a hobbyist beekeeper with a couple of hives, that you ideally don't use a queen excluder. But once again, you know, not going to throw rocks if you do. Once again, to my opinion, you know, there's so many different ways to do things. It might work for you, that's fine. But it's good because what happens is you get a brood cluster. If you've got, say, running, we'll make it easy, two boxes, two 8-frame boxes. If it's in the middle you've got the cluster and it's in the bottom and the second box, you know, you're going to have brood and eggs, larvae, grubs, and honey. So what that's going to happen is you're not going to take that honey that's around it, because what they do is they have that band. They've got the brood, usually a bit of pollen band, and then the honey band. So it'll make you take actually a little bit less. So obviously what do bees need? They need honey to get through winter. So the more you've got for them, I think it's sort of better. So that's what I do. So that's why I don't use a queen excluder. So great question, Josh. If you've got a question or anything at all, please let me know. Absolutely would love to hear. And once again, I am so humbled and full of gratitude for all the amazing messages and emails that people sent and also the reviews. Taking that time, you know, 10 to 90 seconds of your time absolutely means the world to me when you leave a review for this podcast. So thank you so much. And once again, big shout out to Liz. absolute guru. No, absolute. What an amazing person. She is absolute amazing beekeeper, amazing woman doing amazing things. So big, big thank you, Liz.
Thank you so much for listening to Bees with Ben podcast, and we hope you learned some tips and tricks. It would mean a lot if you could please leave a review, and don't forget to subscribe to get instant updates when a new episode is uploaded. See you next week.